Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I'm your host, John Lossoff. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
I can't believe I made this podcast, guys. As you all know, I am an intelligence analyst for the military.
Right.
You know, I consult. I'm not in the military, but I consult for them. And they're like, hey, Mark, this terrorist, he might be taking over this plane. So they sweep me up into this F-117 stealth aircraft. I'm surrounded by commandos, right? We attach to the airplane. I get sucked up. This dude gets paralyzed. A guy who looks like Steven Seagal dies. And it's up to me, a guy that looks like John Leguizamo, and a woman that looks like Holly Berry to stop this terrorist threat and save the plane and everybody on board.
You know, it almost sounds like the entire cast from Executive Decision was flying to their destination to shoot when this happened with you.
Yeah, you know, I was like, you guys look exactly like them. And they're like, yeah, we get it all the time. Yeah. You know, John Leguizamo made a joke about it. Or the guy who looked like John made a joke. And he's like, you know what? Like, the only one person had a nickname in that movie, and it was me, and I was called Rat. Like, they called the Leguizamo Rat. But no, it's tough. I mean, we saved the day, and they gave me a cool ride back, and now I'm here, and I got some new cool, like, you know, commando swag. Right. So I'm looking good tonight.
Yeah, that sounds like it should be a movie. Maybe you could write the screenplay for it.
Yeah, like when it's not what's the word now? It's locked away. You know, I can't tell anybody.
Right.
So you know, in maybe 25 years when they release the papers, they can make a movie. It won't be confidential anymore.
So we're just gonna have to bleep out like this entire part of the podcast.
Yes.
Okay.
You're going to do that, right?
Yeah. Just send me a text afterwards.
Okay.
Living good. Are you going to send me a text reminding me to bleep out that part of the podcast?
I would, but my counterintelligence intel is going to be overwhelming me with texts and tweets because I was cruising around the internet the last few days, and I encountered something that I think will interest Mark, and I wonder if it's come on his radar, or should I say sonar. I've been hearing word that there are rumors about a Jaws remake happening. There's the great response.
You can't recreate Jaws. Everybody's been trying to recreate Jaws. No one, if they had to recreate Jaws, they couldn't tell you how they did it because the shark didn't work, the budget didn't work, Martha's Vineyard people weren't cooperative, they're rewriting every night. Some of the best scenes came from improv. It was an organic, beautiful mess that made my favorite movie of all time. This new one's going to be like the shiny, drone, lifeless, big farts that Hollywood has been issuing out nowadays.
Right. So it's basically saying – you're basically saying you can't recreate the same explosion, right?
No.
The same way.
Because they couldn't –
This was like the Big Bang of movie creations. It's like all the chaos, right?
There's no point. Yeah. I mean, there's like – everything that could have went wrong, the Jaws Log, read it. It's great book, Audible. But it lets you know about how the film was made. And, you know, the shark was beautiful, but, you know, they went through so much trial and error. And there's like John said, it's like two explosions are the same. So, I mean, you can't recreate it. And what they're just going to do is make like a safe version that, I mean, it wouldn't even work nowadays.
Yeah, because sharks aren't as scary to the general public anymore, I feel like.
Yeah, and like imagine if people went out literally to hunt and kill a killer shark. People would go insane. It's their turf. Right. So you would have to like do something stupid and say it's like, you know, a mutated Jaws that's been trained by an evil person to kill. Hmm. It's like Shark Night, that movie on in the lake.
Well, so it's like Dr. Evil got a hold of the sharks from Shark Night, all these different species, and bred them with a couple sharks from Deep Blue Sea, and they spliced it with genes from, what is it, Sharktopus.
This movie needs to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, make that movie. Don't remake Jaws.
There's been a slew of shark movies, and in the last decade, and they've all been pretty campy. So yeah. I don't know if is it going to be like a serious Jaws remake, or is it just like a campy spoof of the original?
I don't know. I think it's a terrible idea.
In all fairness, almost no attempts at shark movies have actually been serious. There have been very few serious attempts.
Okay, here's what needs to happen. Tarantino, Kevin Smith, and there's a bunch of other directors whose favorite film is Jaws. They need to make their own 20-minute Jaws and release it as an anthology film.
Nice. That is that's actually a really cool idea.
Just make that. Make 20, 5 20-minute Jaws films.
The ABCs of Jaws.
That's right.
The JAWs of sharks.
Yeah, exactly. Give me that. Give me a VHS type thing, but with awesome directors and their take on a shark movie.
Right. You know, of all the ideas that we've ever thought that we had that other people did, or things that we thought that you did first and then other people did. If anyone now does that movie, we're getting lawyers.
That's right. And all you random awards folks.
It's our property.
That's right. It is our property. If you make a movie with Deep Blue Sea Shark Knight splits from Dr. Evil and they team up with Sharktopus to attack a coastal lake, somehow it gets into a lake. Because Dolph Lundgren's making a movie called Shark Lake.
Obviously.
No.
It is. Google it. Shark Lake, Dolph Lundgren.
I can't figure out if the last 10 years of Dolph's career have been awesome or horrible.
The greatest. Dude, he's on a career renaissance. The Universal Soldier movies, Expendables. Oh, man. Dude, he's tearing up.
What about his other 80 movies that he released?
Command Performance. He directed that. I love that movie. I think he made Hidden Assassin, though. And no 6'5" Swedish person could ever be a hidden assassin.
Maybe he dresses up as a tree, like a big oak or a redwood.
When he is in Montana, he has a 5% chance of hiding from a whale in the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. He's not a silent or hidden assassin.
Maybe that's just the point of the movie. He's trying to be hidden, but everyone's like, oh, there's the assassin. Dang it.
Yeah. And then it works towards his advantage, Boondock Saints. So I don't know how that would happen, but if Dolph Lundgren ever snuck up on me from remember in the beginning of GoldenEye where Pierce Brosnan's climbing through the the air conditioning ducts and then he goes into the bathroom and punches the guy in the face.
That's not Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, Dolph Lundgren would fall through the thing and land on a guy and smush him. That's how he would get in.
I don't think he would have been able to get in there in the first place.
The twitching limb.
Yeah.
All right, guys. All right, enough Dolph Lundgren talk. I think now it's time to start the podcast, like we do every podcast, with listener questions. Love good. You got the listener questions this week, right?
I do. And listener favorite Brett from Clearwater, Florida, has come up with a couple more for us today. His first question is, who made the worst decision at the time to sign on for the film Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4, The Next Generation? Matthew McConaughey or Renee Zellweger?
So we're basically just talking about career-wise, whether or not it was a good decision.
So this was an interesting case, too, if you guys don't mind me jumping on this. They filmed it in 94, and then they delayed it for 3 years, and then they released it in 20 cities in 97 with a different title and poster. And then because apparently Matthew McConaughey didn't want it hitting big because he had Time to Kill and Amistad coming up, and then Renee Zellweger had Empire Records and Jerry Maguire, so neither one of them wanted to see the light of day. But I'm going to go back to 1994. Maybe they had worked on Dazed and Confused, and I'm going to say the worst idea it was for was I'm going to say Matthew McConaughey, because we've written in the past about every single actress, Jessica Chastain, Elizabeth Olsen, Jennifer Lawrence, Kristen Stewart, they've all been in terrible horror films. Hilary Swank, and they've all, will win Oscars eventually. So, I said it, Kristen Stewart. But I think it's been mathematically, just looking at the thing, it's been easier for them. So McConaughey, because Eddie Murphy would have won an Oscar if it wasn't for Norbit. So I'm saying Matthew McConaughey.
I mean, it's kind of I don't think it was a bad decision for either of them, to be honest. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but I think it was Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's not some random indie horror movie. It's a big you know, horror franchise. Granted, it's not like doing so hot these days, but I feel like that's just like some level of visibility that kind of helps your career. I mean, the movie wasn't great, but I don't think it obviously didn't sink their careers.
So. I mean, it had $600,000. It was a $600,000 budget, I think. Which, if you judge that with inflation, that's more than like the first Insidious. Yeah. So, I mean, it had a decent budget, but I mean, I just heard the script was terrible and everything. But I'm thinking at the time, you know, McConaughey was probably drunk. Some guy probably talked him into it, and then he learned to regret it. What do you think, Levengood?
So, like, I kind of think that this was a no lose situation for them. Again, using hindsight, because I don't think either of them made a good or bad decision. Maybe they both just made a good decision to do it, because neither of them ever had a lead role. If you go into IMDb for anything that they did before filming this fourth Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie, neither of them has ever been billed even like eighth in an ensemble movie before this. And now they're billed one and two. They're sharing the leads for this movie. So even if it's a dud, it gets them some screen time and shows that they can carry more than three lines in a row, which neither of them basically ever had, except for Matthew McConaughey, because the bulk of his scenes in Dazed and Confused are all in front of that convenience shop, like that gas station, for like a few straight minutes, where he just looks at girls walking by.
You'd be a whole lot cooler if you did.
But like, this was their chance to show they could carry more than one scene, basically. They never really had that. So regardless of the quality, and then conveniently, because it was a pretty bad, but albeit grinningly bad, horror movie, like, you know, right after that, the next 2-3 years, yeah, McConaughey, Boys on the Side, Time to Kill, Contact, Renee Zellweger, like you said, Empire Records, Jerry Maguire, like, foresight or hindsight, I think it worked.
Yeah, and like, a lot of critics talk about how bad the movie is, but like, there's some quotes where they're talking about McConaughey, and they're like, he manages to play a murderous nut with more swagger than a role deserves. And then they're saying about Zellweger, she's sweet and sprightly and a natural-born ditz, maybe the only actress who could point a gun bravely at a killer then simply shriek and drop it and scamper away. So maybe, you know, maybe this, like, you know, or maybe it was a terrible experience, but they actually, you know, learned a few skills for later on.
I will say this. Ben Affleck was in Geely, right? And then, like, a decade later, he wins the Oscar, like, Best Director, and now he's, like, you know, he's basically an A-list, you know, Hollywood actor. So I do think there's really no such thing as bad publicity, especially if you're like an actor in Hollywood. So
I'm with you. And like, people are still talking about this movie. Renee Zellweger won't talk about it, but good old McConaughey will joke about it. Like, he just did some direct. There's a video store in Austin that has VHS. They rent VHS, and he's like, he did this whole bit. Then he pulled out the DVD and he pretended like he forgot he was in the movie. So.
I know why Renee Zellweger won't talk about it, because the next Texas Chainsaw Massacre is going to have Leatherface wearing her face, because I don't know what happened to her face in the last few years.
She got
such dramatic plastic surgery. Like, there was nothing wrong. What are we trying to fix?
Allegedly.
Right. Allegedly, she looks like a completely different human with a different genome now.
Allegedly.
All right. So, Renee Zellweger might have gotten plastic surgery. I think that's our answer to the question.
Yeah. Anne Hathaway just had an article saying she's like 34 now or 32, and she's losing roles to 24-year-olds, and she's all mad about it. But then she's like, I was that same person at 22, so I can't be annoyed about it. That's so just, maybe it, like they're trying to, you know.
It's unfair, but that's kind of the reality if you're a female actress in Hollywood. So
yeah, absolutely.
Unless you're like Meryl Streep, then you get nominated for an Oscar every year.
Yeah. Except that Ricky in the Flash movie just made me angry watching the trailers.
That's
like garbage.
No, yeah. No. You know, I coined that term garbage bail film. Like,
she'll get nominated.
She'll get nominated. She'll win Golden Globe.
Really? That's amazing. Really?
And everyone's like, oh, well, are you going to say that to Meryl Streep? And everyone's like, no.
No, I'll let her have it. Yeah, all right, Levengood, what's our next listener question?
Next listener question comes from Twitter, and Demon Scribblers ask just about the weirdest question ever asked.
Really? I would never expect that from someone named Demon Scribblers.
So, yeah, they're horror fiction writers and like horror metal band, like, but they're all over Twitter. But they ask, so The Incredible Melting Man and The Toxic Avenger, match made in heaven's nuclear waste dump or love at first glow? Is this going to be a bromance? Are they going to be arch enemies? What's going on?
Dude, they're enemies, man. Incredible Melting Man, he had to like eat people to become stronger, and then like he just straight up lit people up. But that's that, you know, the Toxic Avenger, he murders people incredibly violent, but they tend to be bad people. So I feel like, I feel like, you know what would happen? The Melting Man would be running around the woods causing a whole bunch of hard you know, problems. Then people would see Toxic Avenger, lump him in with the Melting Man, and you know, then there'd just be like a big battle royale where the Melting Man ends up swept into a trash can.
So Toxie would win that one.
Oh yeah.
You just mop him up.
Yeah. Because he's not going to eat the toxic guy. Like, he's eating humans. He would clean him up. He has that big mop bucket. And at the end of that Incredible Melting Man, they put him in a trash can anyway.
Right. I know. I just imagine, for me, I imagine a scenario.
That's about thing.
Yeah. I imagine a scenario. Did you guys remember that movie with Paul Rudd and Jason Segel, I Love You, Man?
Yeah.
I just imagine those two in, like, in a similar type of plot. They just get to know each other, and it's all awkward, but then they become like best bros and they go see like a Rush concert together. I mean, that's what I picture. So
ooh, I love it. Yeah. They couldn't, like, their furniture would have to be covered in like plastic though.
Well, I mean, they would just hang out in the garage playing Rush songs.
They'd never go inside?
No. Right, because they're
Listen, how would the Melting Man...
Don't apply logic to this. Just take it, Mark.
Knock it off, Hoffmeyer.
God.
You're going to be talking about this later on when you're at Fridays eating all-you-can-eat appetizers. You know what he was asking me? He was like, you know, he asked if they had rubber sheets on the couches in case they were sitting around.
Who does that? Who does that? Hey, can I get more pot stickers?
They're sitting around like, hey, watch that guy. He's about to fart.
Yeah.
I love you, right, man. No?
Yeah.
So I've got a weird theory. I think that they would start MMA, but not mixed martial arts. They'd start Melted Man Anonymous. I mean, get this. Both had a really, really raw deal. Like, okay, both these films were made to next to nothing, so they had cheap, slimy effects, right? Like, it was $250,000 in 77 for Melting Man. It was $500,000 in 84 for Toxic Avenger. And so, not a lot. It's actually surprising they didn't do more with it, though. But, I mean, both these guys suffered, like, a really raw deal. They had something happen to them that neither of them deserved. I mean, you have this astronaut who, like, defies physics by landing on Saturn, which is completely impossible because Saturn is made entirely of gas. But either way, he comes back infected with some monstrous kind of meltiness. And then you got Melvin the janitor, who is thrown face first into a vat of toxic waste by some murderous teen gym addicts. And he turns into a semi-melted monster. And I feel like these guys, they'd meet at a support group. It's 1985. Toxic Avenger had his movie, but Melting Man, like, you know, he's been around for a while. He's just like a vat of ooze right now with a microphone. Somehow he has a speech simulator. And, you know, like, he's helping Toxie deal with his rage and the trials and tribulations of being a partially melted person. And you've got all manner of melted entities, you know, out there. Like, you have the first zombie from Return of the Living Dead. There might be the Blob there. Like, all different stages of meltiness. You know, right. And he's like their mentor. He's
like a support group because he learned it. He ate a lot of people. He murdered people. But then he kind of came around at the end. And now he's like, listen, guys, I've been there. You know, I'll scare you straight because I murdered people in cars and ate them and left ears for people to find when they were trailing me. So I've been there, people. I don't want you going down that. Look where I'm at. I am in a vat right now with a microphone attached to it and a word transmitter. This is miraculous because it's 1985. But, you know, this
I still feel like they should go to a Rush concert, though. I'm just
They'd have
I'm
to get, like, a
like
private
that.
Box with, like, plastic laid everywhere.
Oh, you and the plastic. Those of you.
I don't... You know how much would that be... You know how much you'd have to clean up? Oh.
But then you just have to clean the plastic.
Do they just wear wellies everywhere?
Maybe. I don't know.
I think... You know what?
I'd be like, wear rain jackets and wellies, and you could come to the concert.
Okay. So they have to wear rain jackets and wellies to go to a Rush concert. Is that our final answer?
No air drumming, because goo will fly everywhere.
Yeah. All right, so that's our final answer to this question.
Yes.
Our three extremely different answers. Can you have a tripolar audience? Like, we are instead of bipolar reviews, they're tripolar answers.
Yeah.
Write it down. That's us.
That's Book what we it. Do. We divide audiences.
There's a movie called Tripolar. I'm going to be mad.
All right. I think we've slightly answered that question, if we answered it at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That was a good two listener questions. Thanks again, guys. All right. Mark, I think you've got the topic for us this week.
I do. And if you've been listening or reading Movies, Films, and Flicks for the last 5 years, you'll know that we love random awards. So at the end of every year, summer, mid-year, I've been doing random awards. And instead of going best picture, best actor, best supporting actor, best sound editing, we do like best arm grab, best mustache, best fur coat, best
use of a shoe.
Best use of a shoe. And so it's kind of a fun way to highlight various aspects of movies that you know, I love. We love. And so the random awards have just been a lot of fun. People love coming to our site and reading them. We've actually done random awards before on the podcast. Which episode is it, Levin Good? You know all the episodes.
I believe we're 26. Oh, what? I'm sorry?
Which one was the random awards that we did?
Oh, God, Attack of the Randoms. Wasn't that just our second episode?
Maybe.
I think it's our episode 2, Attack of the Randoms.
See? He's good. See, I knew it. I knew you. It's like a Love Actually.
That's the title, is Attack of the Randoms.
That's a Love Actually moment right there.
You're like a savant when it comes to this podcast.
And so what I did was I now that summer's over, we're going to do summer, May to August, random awards. So instead of doing the best film, blah, blah, blah. And actually, websites have started doing these random awards. It's kind of annoying. I'm not going to say they stole from us, because I don't think that happened. But
I'll say it. They stole from you guys.
But we've been doing this for years. Yeah, exactly, Lazav. Put it down on paper, Lazavath, and then throw it into the non-existent cabinet that you have.
Just in case there are any other websites out there who have these lists, we're just curious for you listeners to look up on their website archives what their oldest post is with such random awards, and then look at Movies, Films, and Flicks oldest. That's right. Just saying.
And so, so what we're doing now are just random awards, and there's going to be 15 total. I have 5. John Levigo has 5. Lazabeth has 5. And then we're just going to have some fun. We're going to talk about the summer movies this season. We're going to talk about what we loved, what we didn't like. And this is just a way to celebrate the randomness of the summer 2015. Right. Without further ado, I want to hand it over to Lazabeth for the first question.
Okay. So I get to kick things off here.
Yeah.
All right.
Wait.
Oh, thank you. My first award is the Best Use of a City Award, and this one goes.
Is that people live in it?
Yeah, city that people live in it, and it goes to the Avengers, to Age of Ultron.
I had no idea where that was going.
You know, most superhero movies, like, it usually ends up with like a destruction of a city. You know, Bane, he blew up Gotham. You know, Man of Steel, Superman, and Zod. That was Zod, right?
Yeah, Zod.
Yeah. It was Zod. Like, they were just, like, basically just had this fist fight that just destroyed, like, Metropolis. Avengers felt like it was just, like, the most creative I've seen. Ultron actually lifted an entire fictional Eastern European city into the air. And the Avengers, they were like, well, we can't save this city now. Let's just save all the people. And then the city just drops, destroying the entire city. It was great. I'm just like, you know, this movie's not as good as the first Avengers, but the destruction in this one is just like on a different level creatively, I felt. So I give it the award for best use of city by just dropping it.
It's very meta. They're going to pick up a city to destroy the world.
Like, well, the city was supposed to act like as a giant asteroid, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
That was something like that.
And then, like, I blame Man of Steel for that, because Man of Steel killed, like, not a billion, but they probably killed a million people. And just a rock'em sock'em robot death punch fight. And ever since then, all these movies have been like, we got to save the people. We got to save, like,
you know, we gotta help out, you know, the innocent folk. So like,
in but Avengers we'll destroy 2, they had that their big, homes in the process.
Yeah, like that one fight in Africa between Iron Man and Hulk. That was all about saving people. And then this whole final fight scene, you literally have 40 characters running around on screen trying to protect some orb. But then you also have a subplot of all these humans getting lifted off this city via helipads. And, geez Louise.
Yeah. It's a lot of helipads.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like we should do a mid-decade random awards and do competition for best hovering city award of the last 5 years. You know, just who had the best hovering city in 5 years of movies.
Well, that's tough.
I mean, there's Elysium, right?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, I hate that movie.
I can't think of any other floating cities that come to mind.
Dark City floated, but that wasn't in the last 5 years. That thing on Captain America 2 is pretty big. Or the Avengers, like that's a big floating city. Kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of. You almost have to pick the worst one, though, because none of them are really good.
Elysium, yuck. Planet Polo.
So can we just have an award where Elysium just loses badly?
Yes. That's my favorite award ever.
Okay. The Don't Give It to Elysium award.
Yeah, there we go. All right. So, what do you got, Levengood?
All right. I have the Least Satisfying Film Striptease Award, and it goes to Magic Mike XXL. Now,
all right.
Am I the only one who's seen this? We got three bros, you know, going live here. I went to see it with my girlfriend. Did anyone else suffer through this movie?
I saw the first one, but I haven't watched the second one.
I was going to red box it.
The first one was fun.
Yeah.
First one was fun. What about you, Laz?
I was going to Redbox it. I saw the first one as well.
You were going to watch it alone at home on Redbox?
Yeah, it would have been awkward just trying to, like, see it in a theater by myself.
Like, this movie, you know, you expect, like, it's going to be, like, they're going to try and put some plot together and some funny male stripper jokes and some funny, awkward, you know, romantic jokes, you know, every 10 minutes, and then you get, like, a strip scene or something. That's what Magic Mike pretty much was. And there were fun scenes with good dancing and cool music, even for a dude, to be honest. But, like, this one, you would go, like, an hour, and there would be none of that. They were just trying to, like, stitch 8 subplots together, none of which were interesting, most of which were awkward. And then when we finally get to this, like, huge stripping, like, extravaganza at the end, it's pretty much lame. Like, my girlfriend thought it was lame. I thought it was horribly lame.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I get it. If you're going to be a movie about that, you might as well have some of that, right? Some of that stripping.
I mean, and there was a lot of awkward in this movie. And I don't mean awkward because I'm a dude watching a movie about male strippers, like, with my girlfriend. I mean, this movie was awkward beyond that notion. So, like, this was even, like, the most anticipated sequel with the least satisfying plot award.
You know, my buddy Ethan worked on that, and they called me up to do 2 weeks on it. But I was working on something else, so I couldn't go down to Savannah to work on it.
You would have been a stand-in for one of the strippers?
No way. Those women in that audience would have mauled me.
Yeah.
They would have seen that 6'4" Sweden torn him apart.
They have to explain it to your wife, like, we're sorry, but there was just no way we could stop those women.
Then we tried our best, but
didn't really try, but we kind of.
it'd be like the old like Jacques Cousteau footage of the anaconda swimming down the Amazon, and he's talking about the piranhas that are upstream, and then like the next shot, you just see a floating anaconda skeleton. After it's like after Mark goes into the crowd of women. There's just a Swedish skeleton with blonde hair left.
I'm just in a bucket. I'm just like, you know, like melted down into a bucket.
He died doing what he loved. He died doing what he loved.
I still have blonde hair. All right. So my first one is best usage of Jason Statham with a fake mustache, best dolphin trainer outfits and sneeze killing, and best usage of big hair. It goes to the movie Spy.
Did you say sneeze killing?
Yeah, there's a scene where Jude Law is like this ultimate Bond spy in the beginning. It's in the trailer, so I'm not giving anything away. And he has this bad guy. You know, he killed all the people in there. Melissa McCarthy's kind of like his eye in the sky. She tells him where everybody is, and then he kills him. And then he's finally on the main, you know, the bad guy, you know. And he has his gun pointed at him. And he sneezes, and his finger pulls, and he shoots the guy right in the face. So, you know, that caused a lot of problems for him. But Spy is the funniest movie I've seen this year by probably in the last several years. I mean, it is – Melissa McCarthy's used right. Like, she's not like a bumbling idiot like in Tammy or Identity Theft. Like, those movies – you know, in Bridesmaid and Bridesmaids, I guess, she's so likable because she's actually talented and nice. You know, she's a little crass, but she's very talented and smart and kind. Like, this movie, she's really nice, but she's very capable. And I just, you know, 50 Cent is in it, Miranda Hart. I mean, Jude Law, Jason Statham is like the biggest idiot. Like, I don't think many maybe Tom Cruise, but I don't think many action stars would do what he did in this film. Like, he's always failing. Melissa McCarthy's always saving his butt. There's a scene where Jason Statham's convinced there's a face-off machine because he heard some guys talking about it in the bathroom. He's like, just put me in the face-off machine. He's like, there's no face-off machine. He's like, well, I heard them talking about it in the bathroom, and the guys start laughing. and then Rose Byrne is in it, and she is like the most vulgar, terrible human being in it. Like, Melissa McCarthy tells this very dramatic story, and this is in a clip too, and I'm not going to say all the words, but after the story, Rose Byrne goes, what a stupid, effing, retarded story. And then she gets pushed down in the movie and like lands on her hair, and Melissa McCarthy's like, your hair blocked your fall. And if you saw the trailer, Melissa McCarthy tells her she looks like a slutty dolphin trainer in one of her outfits, and it's just the funniest movie. And my wife, like, we laughed endlessly, and we want to watch it again. Like, that's the most fun I've had in the theater all year, aside from maybe Rogue Nation. But yeah, so best use of all that stuff.
All right.
So guys, watch it. It's hilarious. Like, you know, it reminded me of like a Mel Brooks type film. It's nothing like a Mel Brooks film, but if you watch Blazing Saddles or Young Frankenstein and those films, everybody's funny. Like, you think about those Spaceballs, everybody is funny. And that's what Spy is. Everyone has their chance to shine. And so, you got to see it.
So you think Melissa McCarthy has a chance to be one of the greatest like comedic actors of our generation? You think?
Yeah, but she just can't go the way of Chevy Chase. When Chevy Chase started, he was very, like, he had characters. He was very dry. But then that became his shtick. So then it became Chevy Chase in, acting, you know, Chevy Chase-like. So I hope Melissa McCarthy doesn't start being, like, that crude, rude person, like in Tammy and Identity Thief. Like, you know what I mean? She started off in Gilmore Girls, and she was really likable. And she needs to remain, you know, unhinged, you know, vulgar, but still, like, nice and capable, because that's where her best roles have been. So if she can keep doing that, then absolutely. I think she'll be around for a very long time.
Well, she's on a roll. She's filming the Ghostbusters reboot at the moment.
Oh, I love everybody in that movie. It's going to be funny. Like, a lot of people are hating it, but Paul Feig, I think his name is, he did Bridesmaids, The Heat. Like, everything he touches is gold. And the actresses in it are good. So I think it's going to be met with skepticism or skeptics, but I think it's going to win people over.
I think it's going to be good. Bill Murray himself is also going to do a cameo in the movie, so.
I love it.
You know, it has Bill Murray's blessing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. If it has Bill Murray's blessing, like, I'm in.
Yeah.
They probably offered him, like, a year of golfing at St. Andrews in Scotland. Listen, and you can drink bourbon.
Why else would I watch Garfield and the sequel? So.
All right. Back to you, Lazavath.
Okay. My second award is the best or, like, the most gratuitous use of a guitar. And this one goes to Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh.
Right. All right. So this is like shortly after Charlize Theron's character and, you know, Mad Max, Tom Hardy, you know, they're on the run, and the Immortan Joe like figure out what's up. So they're like on the chase. And, like, during like the beginning of this chase scene, you see like a kind of nice flyover shot of like all the people chasing them. And then all of a sudden, it just like the camera like kind of zooms in on like this dude, he's like strapped in like the front of like a soundstage that's like on top of a truck, right? And he's playing the guitar in front of like these huge speakers, and they're moving like full speed, by the way. Then all of a sudden, like, you see like, you know, these huge like it's just like you see like these huge clouds of like smoke and fire just like billow out of the guitar, and then you realize it's a guitar slash flamethrower, and he's just like going to town, do like a really awesome guitar solo. It's just like, well, this is amazing. This is, like, no way practical at all, but I'm psyched, you know?
And they actually built that, too. Like,
yeah, it's a real guitar slash flamethrower.
And then he uses it as a weapon later on, and, like, he actually did a pretty good job fighting Tom Hardy when he was trying to go through the vehicles.
What was his role? Like, what was he supposed to do? Like,
the Duke?
like I guess he was just hyping people up. Like he was just play, you know, he wanted to, well, Morton Joe loves Nickelback.
Yeah. Oh, so he was playing a Nickelback song.
Yeah, you know, he was, it sounded like he was playing nu metal.
That's look for at sure. This photograph.
Well, I mean, we talked about this in Free Listeners a lot in episode 16 about Mad Max Free Road, but Mark had brought up back then that pretty much like every character had like their own like mythology, if you will, their own kind of weird backstory just to show their real characters. And this was really one of the weirder ones. If you go online and read about the Doof Warrior.
Yeah. I love it. And like you said, it was the best usage of a guitar this year. Yeah. Hands down.
Was it the best usage of a onesie as well?
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like that might have also been the best usage of a onesie.
Yeah.
Best onesie and guitar playing. Like he's just like no, I love it. And this is gonna sound weird, but you think about movies like Star Wars and other films, you see these side characters for like a minute, and then they have this whole mythology around them, and then like books are written about them. I feel like Mad Max was that kind of movie where there are so many like little side characters that you want to know more about. And Doof Warrior was number one.
I just want to see him like in a concert, like with the actual flamethrower guitar.
Lighten the lead singer on fire.
Guitar solo, get down.
All right, so
I guess is it your turn, Levengood?
Yeah, I'm off. So this movie that I picked, actually, like I could give it, I feel like, half a dozen awards. But the first award that came to mind when this movie popped in my head was the most heartfelt and down to earth eulogy since This Is Where I Leave You award. So the movie is Trainwreck. And I'm not going to say anything about this eulogy other than it is both funny, cutting, and it will, in fact, at the same time, make your eyes water, at least for a second, all in the span of just like 90 seconds. Like, this is a brilliantly written eulogy. But Trainwreck, just it should be that had like the best rationalization of the non-existence of monogamy award, with Colin Quinn lecturing his daughters about sharing each other's toy dolls or how they feel about playing with one doll and only one doll for the rest of their life. And this is easily the most awkward scene from a children's role model award for John Cena, who we see all but a few square inches of him naked, and he's saying some very strange homoerotic things in good comedy taste, I guess, for an R-rated comedy. But then best use of a professional athlete award as well has got to go for LeBron James, because he was brilliantly utilized in that movie. So Trainwreck is just it was a personal sweep for me.
And I read a review where I need to watch it, where LeBron James, there's a line of dialogue where he's like, "Man, I'm not going to practice because all the guys talk about Downton Abbey and I haven't watched it yet."
Yeah. And now that he's in Cleveland, he keeps trying to get his doctor buddy, played by Bill Hader. He's like, "Man, when are you going to come to Cleveland?" He's like, "Well, I don't know. What would we do there?" He says, "No, Cleveland is amazing. What's the difference between Cleveland and Miami?" It's like, and he does that all the time. It's so funny.
You know, my favorite review of Trainwreck actually came from Charles Barkley. He was like, "Oh, they should have called this movie Trainwreck 2 because Trainwreck 1 was the NBA Finals."
Ooh. Oh,
yeah.
Ooh.
Ooh. Sir Charles Barkley, always at the top of his game.
He's playing Godzilla in basketball.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, cool. And so my next one is best moment involving a possessed teenager pulling a kickboxer and kicking off her leg cast on a wooden bed frame, then walking on broken legs while crunching sounds crunch your soul.
Can I please pause you? I heard all that loud and clear, but I want the audience, in case they missed anything, to hear that beautifully phrased award again.
All right. Best moment involving a possessed teenager pulling a kickboxer and kicking off her leg cast on a wooden bed frame and walking on broken legs while crunching sounds crush your soul.
Ooh, wow.
You know, I mean, I would have been perfectly satisfied with best soul-crushing crunching sounds.
So there's this scene in Insidious 3, which we've talked about, and I love this series, but this very nice girl gets possessed by a really jerky demon, and she's in these crutches because she's half-possessed, which is interesting. But then she gets fully possessed and she starts walking on her crutches. She starts kickboxing her castaway. Then she starts walking towards our heroes while her broken legs go. And it's like the grossest, squishiest, crunchy noises. And it's just pure awesomeness from Insidious.
So, yeah, that is definitely there's no competition for that award. We talked about really? That in episode 18. We talked a lot about Insidious and that scene, man. I was so excited about that scene. That was the scene that got me in the theater.
Yeah.
That's what got me to go and pay to see that in the theater right there alone.
I mean, I've never seen that before. Elizabeth, have you seen leg crunching before and then walking on it? Maybe The Rock from Fast 6, but nothing crunched when he did it. Or Fast 7.
No, nothing is nothing crunchy like that, for sure.
You know? So can we write this down in our non-existent file cabinet on your floor that this is the crunchiest leg casting, breaking off, walking, crunching ever?
You know, it's kind of a long title, so it's going to take me a while. Actually, now is probably that's probably a good reason for us to take a break right now while I add that to the file.
Perfect.
All right. We'll see you in a little bit.
Hey, guys. Tonight's podcast is brought to you from Audible.com. And for you, the listeners of Movies, Films, and Flicks, the podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, I love Audible. I've had it for years. And one book that I do recommend when you do sign up for this is City of Thieves, which is written by David Benioff. He is one of the showrunners of Game of Thrones. Everybody loves Game of Thrones. But before he was doing that, he wrote this amazing book about World War II Russia and these two, odd couple trying to find some eggs for a Russian general's daughter's wedding. It is read by Ron Perlman, and it's an absolute blast to read, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. So to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/shark. Again, that's audibletrial.com/shark for your free audiobook.
Sharkdropper Studios presents to you The Force is strong in my family. My father had it. I have it. My sister has it. And you have that power too.
There he is. Back to work.
I had to protect my investment.
Investment?
Julianne Good. The whore with the dead fiancé.
I just hope I can help.
Your reputation precedes you.
If you don't open this fucking door right now, I'm gonna break it down. Go, go, go! Hurry up! Go, go!
Mr. K!
It's Jimmy Jones. He's missing.
Go find him, Tubby.
Polly. We're home.
Oh! Doppel Avenue Hurt. Season 2. Brought to you by Sharkdropper Studios.
Welcome back to the podcast. All right, Mark, what was the name of that award again? I was going to write it down and put it in the filing cabinet, but I got it kind of jumbled up. It was
crunchy Captain Crunch leg crunch.
See, that's what I wrote, but I don't think it sounded right. So
That's crunchily haunted.
I am amazed that you wrote that down and remembered it.
I am too.
Throw it on the floor.
Right. I'm throwing it on the floor right now. Speaking
That's
of,
like an Insidious snap, crackle, pop.
All right. I think... Let me good. I think you have another listener question for us.
I do. I have another question from my longtime friend and a good listener, Brett from Clearwater, Florida. Now, just as there's a disclaimer so that no one thinks that this is a poorly phrased question, we acknowledge Wes Craven, a great horror master, has died recently, and he is a great loss to the horror community. Brett had several weeks ago sent me this question. This is not meant to be a joke. What was going through Wes Craven's mind when he decided to make the 1989 film Shocker?
I mean, of course, on all things to be trusted was Wikipedia. He did this to have like another original trilogy or horror thing. He wanted to kind of make another original horror film with a new bad character, you know, like a new bad guy. But that's what I think. I think he just wanted to bring the world a new killer who gets killed and sucked into electricity and can take people's bodies over and battle with Peter Berg.
Yeah, I mean, but this is a really kind of weird movie. I get that he's going for original, but I mean, IMDb reads, after being sent to the electric chair, a serial killer uses electricity to come back from the dead and carry out his vengeance on the football player who turned him into the police. Like, this feels like it could be a horror comedy, just reading that.
Yeah, no, and, you know, I think he made this, I don't know, maybe he wanted to make something else and didn't work out, so he turned to this, but, like, it kind of got me thinking about Sean Connery, how, like, Sean Connery turned down roles, and then he took League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and, like, that totally bombed. So I think maybe he just wanted to rush into something new, and I don't think it came from an organic place. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like this was more of a force type idea. And there was, like, a lot of dream worlds in it. Like, the kid dreamed about his dad or this killer, who I think was his dad. And they kept it a secret. And then, like, there's dreams. And then, like, there's parents who have a secret. There's a lot of the DNA of Nightmare on Elm Street in this. So, yeah. I just think it came from a kind of a force place.
Yeah, and like 5 years earlier, Nightmare on Elm Street was the last thing that he had 100% written. I mean, he had a part with story components and a major part in writing the characters for part two of Nightmare on Elm Street, but that even that was his last significant writing involvement. So yeah, he wanted something else. Yeah, I read the same. I never knew this, that it was supposed to be part one of a trilogy. But the thing that really caught me was like, I wonder if there's an original cut hidden out there somewhere that was never released or put on DVD or anything because it wasn't a huge movie. Like, I read that Wes Craven had to submit this film 13 separate times to the MPAA board to get an R rating instead of an X rating.
Yeah, I heard it was X rated.
Wow.
13 times. And online, you can read that there were scenes cut that include, like, someone spitting out fingers that they bit off and a more graphic electrocution scene and something about someone stabbing their own hand. But that's just three scenes. Like, is he really just cutting up three scenes for 13 whole different cuts of the movie? Or is there some really extreme stuff that I can't even read about online? Because I looked.
Yeah.
I want to see this original, allegedly, you know, too intense for an R rating cut of Shocker. Because maybe it would have actually been a Shocker and gone to a part two.
I just, I have a hard time buying the villain. Like, I remember I watched it and I was like, like, little kids dreaming about him. And like, but how pissed would you be if, like, you're hanging out, you know, you go to this electrocution to watch this guy die. Then he comes back to haunt you. And it turns out he's your dad, I think, or uncle.
I mean, that is a terrifying notion.
I mean, like, yeah. I'd be like, are you for real? Like, are you kidding with me?
but he got sent to the chair, though, because a football player turned him in. That's critical. A football player.
Yeah. I mean, maybe Wes Craven had, you know, he wanted to kill some bullies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Elizabeth, what do you think?
I think he was just trying to, you know, he was a creative type. So he was just like, he didn't, you know, obviously he didn't want to do the same thing. If you go through his filmography, he's got, like, a decent, you know, I mean, they're mostly horror, but, like, they're all kind of varied. You got The Hills Have Eyes, The Last House on the Left. You know, I'm looking through his filmography right now. I mean,
he's also done some very, very weird movies. Like, he did Deadly Friend and Deadly Blessing, both of which I have watched and reviewed, and they are incredibly bonkers movies. Deadly Blessing is especially erratic.
Yeah.
I mean, it has some effective imagery and some effective clips, but overall, the movie is like a stitchwork horror of weird scenes.
I think his best horror films came from, like, you know, anger or inspired ideas. You know, when he wrote Last House on the Left and those films, like, or Spit on Your Grave, I think he made both of those, or Last House on the Left. They came from, like, a place of, like, anger and, like, pushing it. And, like, when he made Nightmare on Elm Street, that came from a very inspired idea. So this one just has, I don't know, I've searched all over to where the nucleus of this idea came from, and I couldn't hear it. So maybe it was just, I think it was just an attempt to have another Nightmare on Elm Street, which I think doesn't really work in the long run.
Right.
I mean, he did have Scream later on.
Oh, yeah. So but, like, Kevin Williamson wrote that.
Well,
but that was because of New Nightmare.
Yeah.
So it should, like, so basically, here's what happened. Wes Craven directed New Nightmare. He John Stockton and assists to Kevin Williamson, who wrote the Scream script. And then Jeff Hornacek assisted it to Carl Malone, who's Wes Craven, and he slam dunked a fantastic film.
Perfect.
Yep. That's my Utah City Jazz talk for the night.
I seriously think you need to move away from the jazz analogies because they didn't win a ring. I'm just saying.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Wes Anderson hasn't won an Oscar, but he's still great.
Right. So maybe you should save the Utah Jazz for Wes Anderson. I can see Wes Anderson wearing the John Stockton super short shorts. You know?
That's a brilliant idea.
He would cast Luke Wilson for that.
Oh, yeah. That's true. This sounds amazing, guys.
Oh, gosh. These shorts are short.
And Jeff Goldblum's Hornacek.
Yeah.
Jerry Sloan is
Bill
Gene
Murray.
Hackman. Oh, man. I love it.
No, you should have Jason Schwartzman play Carl Malone.
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, Max Fisher's talented, so he could pull it off.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
All right. So the answer to that is a Wes Anderson directed Utah Jazz.
That's the answer to what was going through Wes Craven's mind at the time.
Yeah.
That's what. Okay. Well, thank you, Brett from Clearwater, Florida, for that question and all the questions you've given us for our last couple episodes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Brett.
All right. Back to you, Lazavath.
Okay. My third random
whatever, like, it's so laborious just to think about it, like he's embarrassed about it all.
No, I'm not embarrassed. I'm actually excited for this one.
Uh-oh. Okay, all right,
my third award is the best casting of an Asian American character, and this award goes to Cameron Crowe's Aloha,
right? Yeah. Aloha.
Yeah, so one of the main characters is an Asian American woman. And so, naturally, they went with Emma Stone to play the part. It's just like, you know, when you think of, like, an Asian American woman, you, the first person that comes to mind is Emma Stone. Right?
Now, hold on. I didn't see this. Was he assuming that she was half Irish and half Chinese or Japanese or something? Is that the thing?
I don't know. But, yeah, she plays an Asian American woman in this movie.
So. Like, I saw her in the trailer. I just thought it was Bradley Cooper talking to a white chick.
Yeah.
Well, Levin Good, maybe you should open your mind. There's other races out there. It's not just white people out there.
Like, Emma Stone has apologized for it. Cameron Crowe has apologized for it.
Or maybe, like, Emma Stone is, like, so talented. Like, maybe she could pull off being an Asian American.
They should just defend it with, like, are you such a sexist, you critics out there, that you don't believe that she can pull off playing Asian?
Yeah, that's right.
It's just, why, if you're going to cast Emma Stone, just make her, like, not Asian American. Just avoid that whole controversy. Was it necessary to, like, make her Asian American? Or, I mean, I get why you want to cast Emma Stone, you know, but mm-hmm. I don't know. It was very confusing. So I give this movie that award.
This year, she's like only 22 years old, and last year she was a love interest for Colin Firth, and then this latest movie she's a love interest for Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah.
So it's like she keeps getting put with 40-year-old, 55-year-old men, and then they make her Asian American.
She's stealing all of Anne Hathaway's roles.
Yeah, exactly.
She's trying to
Yes.
She's breaking into the market of white actors playing Asian characters.
Yeah. I mean, Sean Connery did it in the Thunderball. Oh, man. I forget when he was in Japan. I can't. No, not Thunderball.
That was really meta, though, because he's playing like a white dude who's pretending to be an Asian dude.
Yeah, you're right.
Don't forget, in Highlander, he had a Scottish accent, but he was playing an Egyptian.
Yeah.
He was Egyptian. They gave him eye makeup. He was suggesting he was alive in the time of pharaohs. But he talks like Sean Connery. Like, it's fucking, like, you're not even trying. I think I just dropped an F-bomb. I'm sorry, listeners. But it's like, are you kidding me? Like, that's ridiculous.
are we saying that the next movie is going to be Emma Stone in a romantic comedy with Sean Connery?
Yes.
She's playing Sean Connery in the Sean Connery biopic.
I did feel bad for Aloha, though, because I feel like that's the one movie, I think everybody hated it before it came out. Like, no one watched it, and people were picketing it. They're like, it's the worst thing that's ever happened in my life. Really? Yes. Like, people hated it. Like, people were writing reviews about how it was just the worst thing ever before they watched it. So, yeah. I don't know. I find that interesting.
Have you guys watched it?
No.
Yeah, same here.
I mean, I'm going to. It's Cameron Crowe. I mean, I love Cameron Crowe, so I'm saying anything. I mean, when you watch one of his movies, you're going to get something very earnest, very heartfelt. Mm-hmm. I just think, you know, he had his Jerry Maguire.
Almost Famous? Was that Almost Famous?
Yeah, Almost Famous. Oh, yeah. I mean, I liked We Made a Zoo, or We Created a Zoo. Or
Vanilla Sky was also pretty good. Pretty trippy. It was pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Kurt Russell was in that. Like, yeah. I just think, you know, with his two misses, that and Elizabethtown, have really haunted him. But, I mean, I'll watch Cameron Crowe swing and miss all day. Like, at least we have a guy out there trying to put this kind of stuff out there. And he made Say Anything, so I'll check out anything.
Right.
So
you should just watch anything.
Yeah, I'll just watch any movie. All right, Levin, good.
All right, so I had the best fight with absolutely no urgency award. Again, best fight with no urgency. And for me, that goes to Ant-Man, where Ant-Man fights Falcon, played by Anthony Mackie.
Yeah.
That's a good fight. Was loaded with action. It was really, really fun to watch. It was long. They had a lot of clever choreography and things going on. And Paul Rudd is basically like, is Ant-Man apologizing for doing this because he was supposed to steal something from Avengers headquarters. But at the end of the day, like, I felt no urgency. Like, halfway through, I was like, wait a minute. Like, do I care? Like, you know what? I don't care if I care. This is fun.
Yeah. I was listening to the podcast about it and why they came up with that scene. And originally that wasn't in the original script, but they needed a scene where, like, you know, to kind of prove himself before the big heist. So they threw that in there. Then they brought in, like, kind of a rookie Avenger with Anthony Mackie so he could best him, like, because he couldn't best the Hulk or Iron Man. So it was just kind of like a little scene to, like, incorporate the MCU and then, you know, show that Ant-Man has some skills.
Yeah.
And they have a funny line at the end. Don't tell Cap.
You know what else? Like, now that it's done and I've seen it, I like that they, in my opinion, they succeeded at linking it to an Avengers plot without actually just saying it in one line in the whole movie. Like, oh, the Avengers are busy. But, like, the thing is that conceptually, like, on the story writing table, this feels forced to me. Just conceptually, it felt forced. But in execution, this was such a fun movie that it never bothered me one bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought this movie was better than Avengers 2, actually. Or at least I enjoyed it more.
I'll agree.
Yeah.
If Avengers 2 was voiced by had Ultron voiced by a nobody instead of James Spader, I'd agree. But because James Spader was in there with this attitude that really didn't make sense for the smartest robot on the planet. But,
and his head nod, too. He had his
and head nod. But either way, I enjoy listening to James Spader talk so much that I won't say I liked it. Less than Ant-Man. Ant-Man was better, though.
I think it showed Michael Peña's hilarious.
Yeah.
Our last observing report. I thought the 3D looked really good.
I thought the scene where you saw, like, a younger Michael Douglas, that was, I mean, obviously that was CG, but it was so well done. I'm like, whoa, like, that's Michael Douglas, like, you know, back in the day, like in the 80s.
The guys who made Tron were pissed when they saw that scene.
Yeah.
Because their young Jeff Bridges
looks nothing. Oh, that was a good scene. You're right. But I like that. The best fight scene with that really didn't need to happen with no urgency.
No, it was cool, though. Like, oh, look, it's like a little Avengers tie-in moment. I love it.
Yeah. And then that'll come into play later. Yeah. But all right. So here's mine. Best snack stealing award.
Wait, and what?
Best snack, like munchies stealing award. So there's a scene in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I think is a fantastically breezy. It's going to be perfect on HBO and TNT and FX. But there's a scene where they're in a closed marina and there's a boat chase. And there's a heavily armed gunboat chasing down Army Hammer and Henry Cavill, who are the two guys. And Henry Cavill gets thrown from the boat and he swims to this cube truck, this transport van. And in the background, you see Army Hammer driving around in circles while this heavily armored boat is shooting at him. And it's just like a really funny sequence. But then Henry Cavill finds these snacks in his basket, like cheese and bread. And, you know, they're in Italy. And so he's finding all these wine. And so he's sitting there snacking while, you know, in the background, you don't see it at all. Army Hammer's driving, like, it's about 5 minutes long. And Army Hammer's just being chased by this gunboat while Henry Cavill's chilling and eating snacks. And it was like a fun, breezy, smart, joyous moment in a movie that I think more people should watch. So The Man from U.N.C.L.E. had the best snack stealing.
Now, for anyone who hasn't seen that, would you say that that scene and the way you kind of described it, is that kind of the tone of the whole movie?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like Henry Cavill, there's a scene where he gets drugged and he lays down on a couch and puts a pillow underneath his head to get comfy because he's like, I got drugged once and I fell on my head and it really, you know, hurt me later. like it's funny. It's like, I know I keep using this word, but it's very breezy. And it's just like, there's zero, people are like, it shouldn't exist. But there's also zero reason. I don't know why people wouldn't like it. I just think it's fun. I think Guy Ritchie is hitting on all cylinders. Alicia Vikander's in it, who's in A Royal Affair and Ex Machina. She's always good. Hugh Grant's in it. It's just a fun, breezy, I keep saying it, film. And I loved every second of it. It's like one of those movies that you can watch, that I will watch over and over.
Hey, Mark, how would you describe a windy day?
Breezy.
There you go.
Blow us.
Blow us.
It's a blowy day. Wait.
Yeah, like they call it the Windy City. I call it the Breezy City.
Yeah.
Chicago.
It's breezy.
But guys, watch it. It's fun. And you'll just sit there with a smile on your face. You'll leave the theater with a smile on your face. And it's exactly what movies are supposed to do and just entertain.
Mark, I want to see you do a weather report on the Weather Channel, giving us the 5-day forecast.
We got some breezes coming in from the north.
It's going to be a breezy day today.
Got some breezes coming in from the west. This breeze,
tropical storm U.N.C.L.E. is coming into the onset of Florida with breezes at 180 miles an hour.
It's going to breeze in and breeze out, guys. So just clear your breezeways. You know,
prepare
just
get ready for it. Prepare your butts because it's going to be breezing.
Watch it, guys. It's the best snack stealing.
Right.
All right. So Lesbeth.
Okay, my next award is it's the Shia LaBeouf swinging through the jungle with monkeys award. It's the this year, the Shia LaBeouf award goes to Jurassic World for Chris Pratt driving through the through the jungle with velociraptors on a motorcycle. It was just, I don't know, like, I get it. Like, it's, this movie's not taking itself seriously, so why not have Chris Pratt, you know, just like riding on his motorcycle with his pet velociraptors? It was just, it was ridiculous, but it was also like a really fun moment, you know. There was like a little line when like the kid like tells Bryce Dallas Howard like, "Oh, your boyfriend is so cool," you know. It's just like, I'm like, yeah, okay. I mean, this movie's obviously not as good as Jurassic Park. But I don't think this movie really cares, you know.
So when Chris Pratt was riding his motorcycle through tropical forest on a mountainous island, I gotta say he found the flattest run of land possible.
Yeah. Are there no roots or vegetation?
No.
Like, I think that every 10 feet he should have just been flying over the front of those handlebars.
Listen, it's Chris Pratt; he can do no wrong.
It seems like it. It seems like it.
And halfway through the scene, he smiles. Like, he's like, I'm on a dirt bike surrounded by raptors.
Yeah.
You know, there's a theory that Blue's actually the leader of the group.
because like Blue keeps the Raptors off of him. Blue's the one in charge. He just sort of puts up with Chris Pratt, okay. The Raptor.
So behind every good man is a good female Velociraptor. Is what
you're saying? Yeah. Because if you watch, like, I was reading about it. It was on Grantland. They did some summer awards that were kind of random, but they were talking about Blue, and Blue was the leader.
Now, Mark, you actually have a background in film. Would there be like a writing like device name for doing that, for assigning significance to like almost like a prop like character? As opposed to dividing attention evenly across the Velociraptors in this case? I'm fishing here. I'm curious.
Man, I'm trolling right now. I'm not picking up anything.
Like, I feel like that. I feel like there's a strategy behind that.
Well, marketing.
Toys, you mean?
Yeah, because they're all named. So there's Blue now, but then you got to get Alpha and Omega and Zappo. So, maybe it's marketing. But I mean, seriously, when I walk, I don't remember any of the characters' names in that movie. Chris Pratt played Chris Pratt, but I remember Blue.
Yeah.
Like, now that you say that, I actually also cannot remember a single character's name in that movie except for Blue.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. But I have a question, guys. No one can see our faces on the podcast, but what was the face you had when Shia LaBeouf found the perfectly placed vines with monkeys to swing in Crystal? Like, what would the one word to be to describe your reaction to Shia LaBeouf swinging in the vines with monkeys?
It was somewhere between shocked, confused, angry, and incredulousness, if that's a real word.
if he can swim through vines, then that's a word.
I was also just amused. I'm like, okay. Like, because when I was watching Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, because I'm a huge Indiana Jones fan, I'm just like, you know, when you're just trying to, like, just deny, like, reality. I'm just like, you're watching the movie. I'm just like, no, this is a good movie. This is a good movie. And then, you know, you see Shia LaBeouf, like, swinging through the vines next to a bunch of monkeys. I'm just like, I can't do this anymore. I'm sorry. I draw the line right there. I'm sorry.
That movie suffered a greater loss of credibility in my eyes than the Toxic Avenger.
Really?
Like, I was nodding in disapproval less at the Toxic Avenger for its credibility than I was at that.
You know, when he survived a nuclear blast by jumping in a refrigerator, I'm like, you know, I could see that. You know, I'm just like, I was really fighting for the movie. But then, you know, when Shia LaBeouf is like going all Tarzan in the jungle, I'm just like, no. I can't do it anymore. I'm sorry. I just can't. I'm done. Yeah.
It's like a fighter that just jabs you for 12 rounds. Like the first 6 rounds, you're like, I can deal with this. This is fine, you know.
Yeah.
But then by the 12th round, you're just beaten. You keep getting hit. Like that's Indiana Jones right there. It just keeps jabbing you in the face with weird stuff.
Yeah.
All right, Love and Go. What do you got?
All right. I've got two names for the same award. One is the most misleading title award. The alternate name is The Dude Who Throws a Single Left Punch, and they name the movie after it award. And this award goes to Southpaw. And for anyone who hasn't seen Southpaw, you'd assume this is about a left-handed boxer's story. It's not. You'd assume that maybe he switches to Southpaw for a strategy for a fight. That's actually not what happens. The Southpaw notion of this is reduced to 60 seconds during a training montage scene where Forrest Whitaker says, "We're going to go southpaw," a few times. And then 30 seconds of final fight scene where Forrest Whitaker yells, "Go southpaw! Go southpaw!" And then there's one left hook. And scene.
I'd be pissed if my trainer was yelling that, because the opposite boxer would go, "Oh, he's going southpaw."
And that's just it. He is screaming it. Like, he yells it 4 times. Go south, as if it was some code in boxing that the other boxer and trainers wouldn't get.
Yeah. I blame the other boxer, because he's obviously – his in-ring, attention span isn't very good. Like,
Probably why Jake Gyllenhaal's character didn't go southpaw, because he's like, stop saying that. Like, he's losing just throwing rights the whole time. Like, he's like, stop saying that.
You know, I feel bad for Jake Gyllenhaal. He went through all that training and got all jacked up, and like the movie just didn't really do all that well. like critically and commercially.
Scenes were good, and the opening 20 minutes of that movie were so emotionally powerful. But after that, it really couldn't stand on its own legs.
It's just, I mean, what's going through Jake Gyllenhaal's mind? Like, it's like, man, I went through all that, and it was just like, it was just bleh. I don't know. I'm pretty sure he doesn't regret it. He still got paid a lot. So, yeah.
I think he's a great actor, but do you think sometimes he goes too far, like, acting? Like, I love Prisoners. I thought he was very good in Nightcrawler. I think he's been very good for the last, you know, 15, 20 years. But there are moments where it's like, he's acting right now. Like, does that, like, it doesn't come across as natural. Like, Southpaw feels like he was just acting.
He does look for some tough characters who have a lot of tough scenes. So, I mean, maybe it's a product of that. He did well with his role, in my opinion, in this movie. But it wasn't all aces.
I wish that's on the DVD cover.
Like, you got like Ebert's quote, like, yeah, you know, there were some great scenes in here, but it wasn't all aces.
I love it.
It's like, go Southpaw.
Yeah. When he finally swung with his left, was it like Zoolander when he did Magnum?
Okay, let me tell you something else. So when he threw that left punch, the only reason I knew that he threw a left punch, and my eyes were glued. I love fighting movies. I wouldn't have known he threw the left unless Forrest Whitaker went, yeah! Because, like, it wasn't even a tide-turning moment. Like, it's like that was the first of a combination of punches that was a tide-turning, but that punch itself didn't feel like it had any more significant impact in the moment. Like, Forrest Whitaker's like, yeah, that's right. And I'm like, oh, did he do it?
I do hate cinematic hand-holding sometimes. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that seems like, did he get it? Yeah!
Yeah, it's almost like when you're a little kid and you don't know a lot about football yet, but you're excited to be watching the game with your dad. And when your dad says, yeah, you're like, yeah, with a half second delay.
Like, yeah. But, yeah. All right, cool. So I got one right here. It's you had one decent moment that devolved into a bunch of terrible green screen work and lifeless performances. So I'm going to get serious with you guys for a second. All right. I'm going to get real serious. No, I'm not. The Fantastic Four film. I'm going to leave out a lot of the production problems. He said, she said, he said, director said, producer said, studio said. I'm just going to focus on Fantastic Four. There's one good moment in it where Doom, Johnny Storm, and Reed, who are played by fantastic actors, right? Michael B. Johnson, Miles Teller, and Toby Kebbell. And they find out that their machine works, but the government, of course, is going to take it into the Planet Zero. So they go get drunk. And then, you know, out of hubris and drunkenness, they go to this planet. Things go horribly awry, and they get their powers. Now, I like that idea. I like the idea of these young, brash guys getting drunk and then really hurting their friends and each other because of that decision. Like, that makes sense to me. But then the rest of the movie, they just cut to 1 year later, and it's like the most boring green screen. It, like, makes you sad. Like, it's not a good experience, but I kept thinking about it, and a lot of people, Josh Trank was blaming the studio, people were blaming the director, Josh Trank, but I think that this movie had no joy, and it had no life, and there's a scene in Chronicle where the kids who were wasted, you know, and they fell into a green orb and got powers, there's a scene in the film Chronicle where they're flying in they're learning how to fly, and this plane bursts through the clouds and almost hits them, and it's like this joyous, like, life moment where they're just like boundless energy, and there's just joy to it. And in a 20 second scene in Chronicle, that 20 second scene had more life than the entire Fantastic Four.
Wow.
It's not good, it's not fun, it's not so bad, it's good. And if Trank is blaming the studio, he must have had, you know, a little bit in mind. He definitely shares the blame. I don't know how much blame for making these great actors, Miles Teller and Mike, like all these fantastic actors, so bland, and there's no life to it. And it just turned out to be a total wash of a film. And so it had one good moment, and then it just all kind of went to green screen shenanigans.
Yeah.
And rant.
So I really wanted to see this movie. And then I started hearing, oh, no, this is really bad. But I still really wanted to see this movie. And then I started hearing about, you know, the director's issues and a lot of conflict between the actors and the director and who the director did or didn't like and who was getting in fights with who and all these things that didn't work with the movie. And it was somewhere around the 20th or so article that I read that I figured, oh, I'll wait for HBO.
Really?
But I mean, it looked so beautiful. And look, I said it so many times before, but it's so easy for trailers to show us something that looks amazing. But if you cut it just right, that's what it is in 90 seconds. And then you see something that's soul-crushing. But, like, it did look so beautiful, and it had a good cast. And I was so hopeful, not just because it was a comic book movie and I want them to not suck, but this just – I thought it would be different.
No.
Sad.
I read that Chank's original vision for the movie was supposed to be kind of a Cronenberg-style take on a superhero movie.
Which sounds so cool, right?
Yeah, which kind of explains kind of the isolated, closed-in nature of the, I guess, the first half of the movie. So,
not really. It's like him as a kid, and then they develop a thing, and then it's them staring at computer screens for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And then they get their powers, and then they cut to a year later.
But was it thrilling scenes of staring at computer screens?
I mean, they're very good at typing and, like, going, we need the algorithm for the algorithm, and then got it. You know, like, but I, you know, with the Cronenberg thing, and then I was thinking about, you know, they wanted to go a very serious route, and it didn't work. But if you think about the Batman films, they're very serious, and some say overly serious, but they have very iconic images, and there's life to them. That scene where Joker sticks his head out the window of the cop car, and the breeze is hitting his face, that movie is alive, and, like, there's a beating heart. This movie was just like a lump of cement, like, laying there. Like, it wasn't alive. It wasn't fun. He tried to do the Cronenberg thing, maybe, but then, you know, the studio was fighting back on that. I don't know. I'm speculating. But, I mean, it's a good idea, but it just wasn't executed well.
That's too bad, too, especially with the computer screen staring scenes. I mean, I remember back when we did the 1983 Random Awards, and War Games got that award for best computer screen staring. Back then, it was thrilling.
Yeah. And then what, 95, GoldenEye, when the guy was clicking on his pen and typing? That was like, actually, that was the 1995 Random Awards.
Yeah. Honestly, there hasn't been any type of typing like that since Kung Fury with Hacker Man.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Oh, my God. This conversation has gotten so meta weird.
You two go left. I'm going home.
Yeah.
All right, cool. What do you got, Lazvath?
Okay, so this is the last award for me. Okay. I just want to say, full disclosure, this award's sponsored by the U.S. dairy industry. So I may or may not have gotten paid to do this award. But it's called the Got Milk Award. And it goes to Mad Max again, Fury Road. For those of you who don't know, there's a quick scene in the beginning. It shows a Morton Joe's wives. They're hooked up to like I guess what's best described as milking machines to their breasts. And it's basically how he gets milk to his sons to grow big and strong. And they actually showed like all of his wives strapped down, like just pumping out milk. And it was just very, just like the flame wielding guitar. It was very gratuitous, but yet very awesome.
It was like gravaging a goose for foie gras, except with ample women.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it was kind of gross, but at the same time, it's like I'm glad he put that in there.
Were those his wives, or were they like milkmaids?
I don't know. It was kind of hard to tell. I'm just assuming they're his wives.
But see, that's the beauty of this movie. They don't tell you anything, so you're just kind of like, all right.
Yeah. But yeah,
I'd be comfortable assuming that they were like his earlier wives who have gotten older, because he has all manner of aged children.
Yeah.
And
because don't forget, like the big guy Rictus. Well, I mean, the actor anyway is in his 40s, and then there was a dwarf, and he was also a son of a Morton Joe, and that character had to be closing in on 50 or so. And so, like, they might have, you know, they're mothers that we don't even see.
Guys, we're writing fan fiction right now.
And, yeah, so, I mean, maybe just as they get older and they're no longer of interest to him for fertile means or entertainment, they still get fed well and they get protected and they get water privileges, but that's their life. They sit in there and milk.
I mean,
it doesn't really sound like a life, but I'm not justifying this life. You know, I remember when the American American Dairy Association in 1991 sponsored one of our awards. It went to Ernest Scared Stupid.
Oh, the MEAC.
Oh, man. Pure Bulgarian MEAC.
Yeah.
MEAC? Yes, Stubby. I bet you didn't think I was quite light on my feet.
Wait, so, this is kind of a gross question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What do you think tastes better, Bulgarian MEAC or the Morton Joe special milk?
Special milk.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy got pretty big. He's healthy.
What really is MEAC?
It's
You looked this up a while ago, didn't you, Mark?
It's what's in Brondo.
Yeah. Along with the electrolytes.
Yeah.
it's what the body craves.
Yeah. It's a salty milk, really. That's what we're trying to say.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah. I mean, it keeps you hydrated, though. It's good.
Yeah, it's good.
For those tough, it's like a, but see, if you drink regular milk, you'll end up like, an Anchorman.
You'll get the calcium. You'll get the electrolytes. You'll get the vitamin D. You'll get the calcium. It's all in that one glass of milk, MEAC. So it's good.
All right, send your check, MEAC, to John Lazavap, St. Petersburg, Florida. All right, Levin, go. What do you got?
So this is the Best Ongoing Rap Battle Award, and it goes to Straight Outta Compton. That movie had some of the most powerful rapping that I've ever heard. And, of course, they're playing songs that, you know, I heard 20 years ago, basically. But I love the way that they staged the songs, because after the band basically splits up, they're talking trash about each other. And right after one of them hears a song on the radio, you know, with its cool lyrics, then you got like, you know, young Ice Cube. He's just rapping right away in the recording studio, like answering back. And you see the other guys listening to it later in time lapse. And I don't know, it was so cool. Like, that was the best music video I ever saw.
Nice. That's like the podcast thing we had a while back where we just would diss each other via podcast, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was, things got a little heated, but,
you know, that movie, though, like, I really loved that movie, and I was so disappointed when I found out that a lot of things were fictionalized. But, I mean, even that withstanding, because it glamorizes and hides some of the real things that happen. But even that withstanding, this was a great movie. And it's long. In the first 90 minutes, though, like, if you ever liked an NWA song or an Ice Cube song ever, you will probably adore this movie, and all the acting performances are breakout.
Well,
they're all great.
It's now currently the highest grossing musical biopic of all time. So a lot of people would agree with you.
It will probably stay that way for over a decade. I mean, it's powerful.
Well, until they do the Tupac, Suge Knight, Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg movie, which I guess they're making now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
They did. They got a great guy to come in as Snoop Dogg in this movie. Some people were like, he's not tall and skinny enough. I'm like, you think they're going to cast someone who can both act and has the body structure of Snoop Dogg? Like, are you nuts? Are we cloning him?
The guy they got for Tupac looked spot on, though. Like, whoa. Like, I thought that was him. I knew he was still alive.
This is going to sound random, but you know how Jurassic Park was in the 90s? And, like, it made so much money now, or Jurassic World now, because a lot of people had the nostalgia for Jurassic Park. Do you think a lot of people our age who, like, listened to this growing up saw the movie come out and all went to it? So it's like a, you know, it's a good movie as well, but, like, do you think people, you know, nostalgia brought people to it? Or, like, you know, stuff from the past. Does that make sense?
It's like the Jurassic World of musical biopics.
Yeah, I would say that.
Yeah.
I would have never gone to see this movie if I didn't know the names of some of the songs that were performed in it.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think Jurassic World would have done as well had it not been for the love of Jurassic Park. Mm. So I like it. It's the Jurassic Park of music biopics.
You know, one of my friends was even telling me he never was into rap back when these guys came out as NWA, or even after they first started splitting. Like, he didn't start listening until, like, basically 6-7 years into their timeline, which is more than halfway through the movie, like way more than that, when, like, California Love came out or whatever, and that big 1996 music video with Dre and Tupac and all them, and like that was where he started listening, and even he said, yeah, it's like, yeah, I remember that song, so like I thought it'd be cool to see the movie. That was the whole reason that he said he saw the movie.
Yeah.
He's like, oh yeah, that movie that came out, like, it's like, dude, that's like the third act of the movie.
Because they didn't just like pop up on the scene; they exploded on the scene.
Oh yeah.
So, cool. Yeah. So my final award is the Kurt Russell of summer 2015.
Yeah.
All right.
So what does that mean? What does that mean exactly?
Well, like, you know, they have to be human. They have to be in over their heads. There has to be more powerful people around them. They kind of have to like fail up and pull magic out of, you know, out of nowhere. And I am going with, you know, just, you know, even though we're not, I wasn't a huge fan of the movie. I'm going to go with Jeremy Renner as Hawkeye in Avengers 2. Because while they're picking up the city, while, you know, the most powerful robot is fighting, while everything's going on, we have this human with a bow and arrow running around really slow and being made fun of by faster people. And, you know, there's that scene where Scarlet Witch, Olsen, she's like putting nightmares into people's heads, and he like stabs something into her head. Like, you know, that's pretty badass that he did that. He prevented it all. Like, only the human could stop her. Like, all the other guys got in trouble. So he's the Kurt Russell of summer 2015.
Yeah.
Because she's busy focusing on all the more dangerous members of his team. He just gets to sneak up behind her.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but he has like that knife, you know, the knife throwing scene from Big Trouble in Little China. Like, mm-hmm. He has that kind of scene, and he's just like, you know, and actually Kurt Russell has great reflexes. Jeremy Renner has great reflexes in this movie. So he's the Kurt Russell.
Yeah, it all makes sense.
Yep.
All right.
Did you have one, Loving Good?
For that topic?
Yeah.
No, man. You know what? Let's go with O'Shea Jackson Jr. and Straight Outta Compton, because he's a no-name actor who just came in to play his dad because he looks like him, and I'll bet there's going to be Oscar buzz. This is like a real-life Kurt Russelling.
I like it.
Not even a character. Like, he came into this movie and just nailed the hell out of this movie, and I think I liked his rap more than I liked his dad's.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
All right.
Well, then the story of the character, too. You know, they came from nothing, and, like, you know, he wasn't getting paid when he was in NWA, so he just left at a time when, as I only know from the movie explaining it, at a time when rap groups were doing well, but solo rap acts were failing, and he just went solo, and it somehow kicked butt. Of course, yeah. He wasn't failing up. He was just awesome.
Yeah.
Then he went on to make Friday.
And now he's a cop in every movie.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, yeah. An really angry cop.
Yeah.
Angry cop.
Hey, don't mess with Korean Jesus. He's busy with Korean shit.
All right. So that does it for our 2015 Summer Random Awards. Hopefully you guys were entertained. There was a musical number in there. We had to edit it out.
What?
Yeah, I know. I know you guys rehearsed it for like months, but due to time constraints, we had to edit it out.
Did you take out that one thing, or do I still need to text you?
Just text me. I'll let you know. All right, guys, before we sign off, do we have any plugs to make?
Go to the website, www.moviesfilmsandflicks.com. Go to Blog Talk Radio. Go to iTunes. Check out Shark Dropper. Check out Paralyzed. Check out Man from U.N.C.L.E. Dance.
Yeah. Yeah, everything Mark said. Also, quick announcement. I'm going to be at next month, September 18th to 20th, I'm going to be at L.A. Podfest. So if any of you listeners are going to that, or if you're in the area and you want to say hi, feel free to do so. I'll be joined by my Shark Dropper colleagues, Robert Lamb and Jonathan Moss, and we'd love to meet you. So, yeah.
Just buy him a drink.
Yeah, seriously, buy us a drink. Plane tickets aren't cheap, so... Yeah,
I want to know who is going to go to LA Podcast just because you said you were going to be there.
Well, I guess we're going to find out.
Oh, yeah. Tickets are selling out.
Yeah. All right, guys. I think that does it for a podcast. My co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
Kurt Russell.
Yes. John Levengood.
Dolph Lundgren.
I've been your host, John Lasso. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you guys next time.
the target. T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.